outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gene. The God Gene. The God Gene.
Well, if you're hearing this, I'm back from Oklahoma. The problem is I haven't recorded anything since I got back. This is recorded before, so maybe next podcast we can catch up a bit on that. This is a podcast with a friend we've had on before, Josh Packard, sociologist, professor at the University of Northern Colorado, wrote the book Church Refugees with Ashley Hope. Different project now, talking about connections for people that are isolated and lonely. I thought this would be a great podcast since we've been talking about some of these things and just finished it with him, so I know you're going to enjoy it. So here is my conversation with Josh Packard. Well, I want to welcome back Josh Packard to the podcast. Josh, it's been since May 2015, I think we last heard from you.
I guess it is. It's almost 5 years ago. That's strange to think, but it doesn't seem like that long.
At the time, you were a sociologist, college prof, author of a book called Church Refugees. Are you still doing the college stuff or have you moved on to something else?
Well, yeah, I'm still at the University of Northern Colorado and currently helping to launch a new effort called Springtide Research Institute, which I'm sure we'll talk more about. But yeah, still here, still teaching, still involved with students.
Still researching. Still
doing research.
We enjoyed Church Refugees here. We did a couple podcasts on it back when it first came out, actually even before it came out. You co-wrote that with Ashley Hope, who I got a chance to meet in Nashville or somewhere in Tennessee when I was going through the area, and she came out to visit, her and her husband. So
yeah, that's great. And Ashley is now, I mean, she wrote, when we started writing that book together, she was an undergraduate with me here, and now she has her PhD and is working in Austin at a research firm. It's a lovely success story. You know, when you're an educator, you hold on to those because there's so many students that you don't have any idea what happens to them. And so it's nice when you...
Oh, that's great to hear. I haven't heard anything from her since we saw her in Tennessee. But so tell me a little bit about... Let's go back and talk about Church Refugees. That was, what, 5 years ago now? I'm curious as to whether you saw that book make an impact. And if so, where do you think it made an impact in terms of people who kind of disillusioned, have dropped out of more institutional things? And at the time, I was with you at a conference, the institutional concerns were trying to find a way to help those refugees come back. So this kind of a five-year long-range view back at the mountain, what does it look like to you?
Well, this will not be a surprise to you or to your audience. I'm not sure how much of a surprise it is to me as much as it is still just a disappointment, which is that, you know, I think the book had very little impact on the institutional church. I think they largely looked at it, and it sold well, was read widely. I was invited to speak and talk to lots of people about it, but I'm not sure that it moved the needle in any real way in any single church I can think of. But where it did make a difference, and it matters more to me in a lot of ways because these are individuals and not orgs, is with the people who not only participated in the research, but then the people who came to see themselves as being identified in those pages. And felt like, you know, I had so many people reach out to me, and this was new for me as an academic to say, you know, for the first time somebody's telling my story, and I knew it wasn't the first time. I knew there were people like you out there doing this too, but they didn't know,
right?
And so that was really gratifying, and it sort of sent me down like this pathway of thinking like, who else's stories are not being told, and who else is being ignored? So it was really satisfying in a very particular kind of way, and makes me still sort of sad for the institutional church.
It seems like the institutional church is just kind of doubles down on its whole be committed to us. You need to get back here and be this part of thing. It doesn't move easily. I know Barna's research had done a lot of stuff to try to help that entity take a different look at how to reach out to its audience, and kind of comes up with the same thing. That pretty much is what it is, and it doesn't seem to move much from that. It's asking people to like what we are, not willing to look at how we might change to incorporate more people.
And I think that's so strange, Wayne, because when I go out and give talks about your church refugees or even just the state of religion in America, one of the things that I point out to them, and somebody just asked this question on Twitter, what do you love most about your religious tradition and what frustrates you most? And for me, it's the same thing. I love that at the root of Christianity in America is innovation. You know, there's no state-sponsored church or religious expression, and that has created a marketplace of sorts where religious ideas can thrive and compete, and people could be entrepreneurial. And that we didn't just have one great awakening. As you know, we had two. we felt like the job wasn't done.
Yeah.
And yet, with all that innovation in its history and at its roots, we now seem like just the church seems so resistant to change of any kind that would, you know, adapt to the current society. It's very odd to me. It's disheartening.
Yeah, I got an email from someone going through a very similar thing and being interrogated because she's kind of stepped away from this institutionalized thing, which seems to be, by her perception, a bit abusive, not just neutral, sure, but a little bit abusive. She steps away. She's gotten all kinds of, what are you doing? You're doing the wrong thing. And her statement was interesting. She said, the assumption is because I stepped away, there's something wrong with me. No one ever asks, is there something wrong with us, what we're doing here? And I thought, you know what, that speaks for a lot of people, because I don't think those entities very well ever question themselves. It's we're here, we're God sanctified, and doggone it, you better be here too, or we're going to judge you pretty harshly.
Yeah, they don't. You know, one of the things that hadn't come out when we first talked about church refugees is the follow-up that we did later that summer, which was a national survey. So the book is, as you know, largely qualitative. I mean, it's completely qualitative. It's 100 in-depth interviews with people who didn't even see themselves as a category, you know, really. We had to go and search for them and tell them they were part of a category so they would talk to us. And then we started doing, we did a survey in a national, and realized that, like, there were some, you know, millions of people, like 7.5 million people at that time sitting in pews who told us on the survey that they were 1 foot out the door. They're probably going to leave soon.
Right.
And like, oh, the church has no idea about this. Like, they just don't pay attention to their back door at all.
Seems to be true. I mean, I know a continued outflow of people from those things. And the only ones that seem to be growing are the bigger, big box kinds of things that offer a lot of programs to draw people in. But
yeah,
I'm glad spiritual hunger is still there, though. People are still hungry for Jesus, hungry for a real journey. And if they're not finding it there, they are looking in other places for that similar kind of community, not similar, even maybe just more authentic community, and ways to reach out into the world, and people are finding it. So that's always encouraging to me.
I agree. I mean, if you look at the numbers, the latest numbers from Pew and Gallup and others, you know, the rate at which people pray is still really high. The rate at which people believe in God is still really high. I mean, this is largely, you know, the church gets in trouble here because the church sees the current trends and thinks that it is the center of that story. And the reality is that the church is just one character in a larger story about institutional distrust and disaffiliation across all sectors. So just as much as we've turned away from churches, we've turned away from, you know, institutional politics, we've turned away from organized, you know, education. People don't participate in their PTA like they used to. They don't trust anybody at all. If you look at trust levels, they've fallen off a cliff. And when you contextualize it that way, you begin to understand that people still have the same orientations, more or less, towards life's most important questions. You know, what's going to happen when I die? Why am I here? What am I supposed to do with my life? As they've ever had. It's just that they're disconnected from the leaders and institutions who used to help them answer it. And so they're sort of, you know, in many cases, wandering around. And hope, you know, I think, you know, and the very fortunate people get connected to you in this podcast or to other people like you doing that kind of work. But now you've got whole generations growing up. They're not leaving the church. They weren't in it to begin with. And so they're not necessarily out there bumping into people like you. And you're still trying to answer these questions. And that's sort of actually terrifying.
And maybe the larger lesson here, I kind of chuckle when you talked about the impact on institutions, but do any of us as authors ever get the impact we think our book could make on the world?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, for sure. Way more people should have read it. You know.
What interests me is there's just an endless set of books that get released on the same topics year after year after year. And the needles that I care about never seem to move back towards something more thriving, more realistic, more helpful, more authentic to the mission of Jesus in the world. It's our religious replications of that. And that's even not just Christianity. Other religious groups deal with the same thing. They Absolutely. Harden into such structures and rituals that people who still have a hunger on their heart no longer feel like they fit in there and go looking elsewhere. And I think there are a lot of resources out there that people are finding now. And I meet people all over that are still on a really good Jesus journey, in spite of the fact that the religious establishment they were part of didn't really serve them well. And I find the people most contented in their religious environment are those that are I come from this more conservative wing, this more fundamentalist wing that's almost always a bit more abusive, a bit more authoritarian. And people who seem to go to mainline churches seem to have a greater freedom to maintain their passion and not be so distracted by the stuff they hear from the pulpit every Sunday morning. Where more conservative traditions, with the guilt messages and the anger and the alienation from the world, people just get really tired of hearing that Sunday after Sunday after Sunday.
And especially when it's so far out of step with the other 6 days and 23 hours of their life.
Yeah.
you know, it's not that people have sort of woken up by any stretch. I don't think the world has changed that much. It's that they're now inundated in a world where, like, that message just largely doesn't have much play throughout the rest of their lives. And so it's a lot of cognitive dissonance to sit there and say, like, oh, right, like, you know, women deserve secondary status and on and on and on. And it's like, it's just really hard to maintain when you spend the rest of your life in places where, for good reason, those things don't hold.
Right. And it seems like what's left is the obligation of, you know, everybody used to go Sunday mornings, the place you made business contacts and other things going on in your community. That seems to be gone now. There's no real cultural press to get people to sit in a Sunday morning thing. So whatever that was, if it was guilt, obligation, if it was just meeting other people, socializing in your community, all that's kind of gone. I think the big box churches kind of help do that. And we're sitting with strangers every Sunday. We're not sitting with people we know. Well, enough of all that. I mean, that was a big part of your life for a season. How did you get from there to Springtide Research Institute? And what are you doing now? And I, being that you're still a professor, I guess this is kind of a side thing.
Yeah,
in your pocket?
We're just getting off the ground here. And we've got our first report called Belonging, Reconnecting America's Loneliest Generation, coming out at the end of March. The focus at Springtide is on 13 to 25 year olds. And our realization very early on is that it didn't make sense to think about disaffiliation anymore. You know, the churches, largely institutional churches in this country, not just Christian churches, but synagogues, mosques, et cetera, are just now dealing with the idea of people leaving. And we're like, y'all are behind that game. Like, the game that's out there now is that they weren't connected to you ever. So rather than looking at, you know, what we say is the intersection between their inner and outer lives, or between their spiritual and daily lives, just through the lens of being Catholic, or just through the lens of being Jewish or Protestant, that didn't make any sense because they didn't identify with those labels ever anyway. And so, you know, if you were just picking that one bucket, you'd be leaving out something like, you know, depending on, even if you pick the largest bucket, you're leaving out something like 65% of all young people. But we kept the, just as you were referring to, you know, adults, like, we kept hearing two things that made us at Springtide really think that there was a problem that needed to be addressed, which is young people were still asking the same kinds of questions they've been asking, you know, the same kinds of questions they asked in 2009 and 1999 and, you know, 1970, you know, it's all these big, like, identity kinds of questions and, you know, purpose and meaning kinds of questions. And we kept hearing from really well-intended and good-meaning adults who want to help them through that, like, navigating those things. But they just really lack current. I mean, I don't think that the church and the, you know, cultural leaders who interact with young people, I don't think they have very good data. I don't think they have very good accurate understanding of what's really going on in the hearts and minds of 14, 15, 16-year-olds, like, at all.
Why did you pick that age bracket, that 13 to 25? What kind of drew you into that framework?
Yeah, so with that in mind, then that's why we honed in on trying to bring those groups together. So 13 to 25 is it starts at about the age that most traditions, most cultural places are, you know, it's middle school, but there's also rites of passage that go on there, bar mitzvahs, bat mitzvahs, confirmation classes, et cetera. And then up to 25, because we thought, like, we looked at the research about when young people are starting to actually leave home and be on their own. And that's about the time that most of the social science data says that it tips. It's not this, you know, sort of traditional 18 or 22 years old anymore. It's a little bit extended. So we really wanted to capture that before they were sort of off in the world by themselves.
Okay, and you've got a new paper coming out on this. Is it a book too, or just a paper, or what is it?
So it's a robust research report full of really pretty infographics. Thank goodness that as a researcher, I get to work with designers on this, because these are not things I could ever make. So it's okay. Really digestible and easy to consume.
And who's it aimed at? Who do you hope reads this?
Yeah, our target audience, you know, at Springtide, we say our target audience is anybody who works in an official capacity with young people. But for this report in particular, I think that the sort of bullseye here is for faith leaders and teachers who are working in, you know, private schools and other places. And that's because of some of the, and I think it'll apply to a lot of other groups, but in particular, we asked them, and we found some just really astonishing things, but then we would ask them through a lens also of religion to figure out, like, what is the relationship in this case between isolation and loneliness and the church?
And so you call it Belonging, Reconnecting America's Loneliest Generation. Are you saying that 13 to 25-year-old plane is the loneliest generation?
Yeah, it's sort of shocking. So UCLA, some researchers from UCLA have created the UCLA Loneliness Index. It's been around for a long time. And occasionally researchers will dig it out and dust it off and, see where we're at with it. And almost always it's, generally what you would imagine, which is that it's the elderly who rank as the most lonely and isolated of all of our current generations whenever they administer the tool, because for obvious reasons, we don't need to go into that. Cigna, the healthcare provider, just launched a massive study because they sensed that something was shifting among the people that they were treating and serving in 2017. And what they found was actually really eye-opening, which is that seniors weren't the loneliest. In fact, it was Generation Z, which is the youngest of the people that they surveyed. And it was the first time ever that the youngest generation had been the loneliest, and their rates were higher than they had ever been before. So it put a name to the thing that we kept experiencing between that mismatch of young people asking questions but not having adults in their lives that they could, really go to or felt like they could trust.
Yeah, I heard one of the news podcasts I listened to a couple of weeks ago was talking about the loneliest person at work. That was the headline.
Yeah.
And when they finally got to it, it was the youngest workers in the office are the loneliest. Not the, you think maybe the people approaching retirement or people kind of up in wavelengths, but they're saying, no, this younger generation, the newer ones in the workplace just feel incredibly disconnected from everybody else that's there. And so they deal with loneliness, they deal with depression, they deal with some of those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And they were encouraging people to kind of reach out to the younger audiences. What did you learn about the loneliness of this generation and how it is that we might reach into that to help them find connection?
Yeah, and it's interesting, the thing you mentioned about work, that's actually one of our upcoming studies, is about finding meaning at work, because we've been picking up on the same kinds of stories and trends about loneliness. So first of all, we confirmed that what Cigna found is the same thing that we found. One in three of the young people that we surveyed said that they feel alone much of the time. That's 30%. Nearly 40% of people feel like they have no one to talk to and that they're left out some or all of the time. Just astonishing numbers that I wish that they were anomalies, but they underscore the same kinds of things that that we're finding from other places. That wasn't entirely surprising to us, because we felt like, okay, we've seen enough of the ancillary evidence. We were pretty surprised. We were pretty much expecting that that's what we were going to find. There were some other things in there though that we worked from that hypothesis, because we didn't want to just repeat what other people were doing. We had this hypothesis like, oh, well, I'm sure that if you're going to church, like it probably means you're less lonely. Probably means you're less isolated, right? Because I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, like that was a big point of social connection for me. I went to a youth group, and I don't know if they still do lock-ins anymore, but I did lock-ins, and I'm sure drove my youth director crazy. Some of my best friends were there. But now in a world where like nearly 40% of young people feel like nobody knows them well, and over a third of them told us that they were connected to. Wayne, this is astonishing. A third of them told us that they were connected to one or fewer trusted adult in their life, and that includes their parents.
Wow.
I mean, that was, to me, that is like an automatic spiritual problem, right? It is not a big leap of logic to understand. And of course, the consequences for that are increased stress, increased mental health issues, et cetera, et cetera. And we're really interested to find so what are the antidotes here? And we thought church, we're like, naturally, this is going to be one of them. I mean, it's hard to, if you're going to an institution whose job it is to make meaning out of your life, you can't feel like your life doesn't have meaning. If you're going to a place that has all these programs and you're there, you can't be disconnected from people. And what we found was that attendance at church events, youth groups, services, what have you, had literally zero impact on young people's feelings of isolation and loneliness.
Wow.
Which was just, I mean, We like looked at the data and we're like, that can't be true. We ran it. We redownloaded the whole data set just to see if we did something wrong. And then looked at the stuff again. But it was still the same. Nearly 25% of young people who attend worship gatherings every week still feel as though no one understands them.
So it's really, it's not so much an institutional failure. It's just a crisis of friendship and connection. Is it an age group that doesn't know how to connect relationally? There's been a lot of talk about, all the screen time and all the things that people do for media. Is that getting in the way of friendships, or is that connected at all to what you're seeing?
So it definitely does matter. In fact, I had somebody at a conference, I was presenting this a few weeks ago, and somebody said, well, they're always on their phones. And I was like, well, okay. We're not going to change that. I don't think anybody's doing research to suggest how you get 14-year-olds off of their phones all the time or 16-year-olds to stop checking Instagram. So what do you do about it? I think what it is indicative of is how much our world has changed. So I think that using myself as an example, when I was growing up in the church, attendance did mean that I was connected. And it did mean that I was having meaningful relationships with adults when I was there and I was, my peers, et cetera. It doesn't mean that anymore. So while church attendance made no difference, the thing that did make a difference was if you went to a church and you were connected to an adult while you were there. Hmm. So a connection with a trusted adult drops the rates of severe and the effects of severe isolation and loneliness dramatically. So I'll give you just one example. Young people saying, I feel completely alone, right? So just looking at the young people who attend religious gatherings, 32% of young people who have zero trusted adults in their lives but still go to religious gatherings still say they're alone. But if they even have just one adult that they connect with at those religious gatherings, that number drops more than half to just 14%. And that's just with one. If we get up to 2, 3, 4, 5 adults in their lives, that number drops almost to nothing. So it's pointing to this anti sort of programmatic model. And we've got lots of other data here. I won't spew numbers at you all day, but it's pointing towards the power and importance of relationships in this world where we don't trust institutions anymore. We can't keep leaning into these institutional responses. We have to start leading with relationships.
Yeah. When I was in education a while back and did some educational stuff, I attended a workshop that talked about 42 community assets that reach out to at-risk youth, all the way from boys clubs to girls clubs, blah, blah, blah. And they said the only one that mattered of these 42 community assets that had the power to change the trajectory of an at-risk youth was a caring relationship with a non-parent adult, which is the same thing you're getting to here. And yet, man, those are not always easy, because it's not just a youth director up on a stage leading a big program. It's somebody who takes an interest in them. The youth group may provide a venue for a connection to happen with somebody in the youth group, but it's not by virtue of being in the youth group that what you're talking about takes place.
Right. In fact, I would say that, you're well versed in this. You understand the problems, and I'm happy to talk about them just to name them if you want, but the notion of a youth director standing up in front of a group of people and giving a talk as if that makes any difference at all in the long-term health or connection of a young person's life is sort of preposterous. I mean, I don't know how much more convincing the data need to be before people stop doing that, but I understand the institutional pressures that keep youth directors doing those kinds of things.
Well, let's take it back to family, because the disconnection is as much with parents as it is in religious communities. If a parent, particularly, 13, 14, 15 is when kids start to withdraw from the parent thing and trying out their wings. Do you have anything that helps parents who say, man, I'm losing connection with my teenager, but I don't want to.
Yeah.
How can I find my way back into their life? You got anything that's helped you there?
Yeah. So that was one of the things that was really nice to see, is that the importance of adults in the lives of young people was confirmed, maybe more than ever now that adults are important. So I think it's just important. Like, the crucial insight for us was, just because they're on their phones doesn't mean they're connected. And just because they're not talking to you doesn't mean they don't want you to talk to them. And so in the qualitative, in the interviews that we did following up on the survey or alongside the survey, we kept asking, it was one of those other aha moments where we kept asking them, where do you feel like you most belong? And they like the young people that we were talking to couldn't even tell us where. They kept telling us who, right? Who made them feel like they belonged most. And a lot of times that was still parents. And so I think if I had one thing to say about that, it would be don't underestimate how much your, you know, kids, especially if you're, you know, your kids in the house still want you to be involved with their lives. They want to know that you care. And how important that still is for them, because at least our data, you know, confirms that that's super important.
Yeah. I think I'm gonna have my daughter on after this. I want to have her talk. She'd be doing some podcasts with me about parenting, and I'd be really interested to know, because she's dealing with this with one of her, as her kids are now coming into their teenage years. And that is, how do you maintain that connection? And one of the things she'll say is, it's not so much those parenting moments when you're like, okay, let's sit down and have a conversation about what's going on in your life, and the kid feels really put on the spot. It's more when you're, you know, just having some alone time with them, going out to dinner or just shopping, but you're with them. And out of the just being with, there's the chance for these kinds of conversations to emerge. And the most important thing, I think, is what you're saying, is you got to show them that you care. And if you care, they'll let you in. And even if they're acting kind of cool as kids and mom and dad aren't cool anymore, blah, blah, that's not really what they're wanting on the inside, which I think is very helpful for people to know.
I agree. And it can, I know that it can feel like you're doing nothing to sit and listen to a young person, but you're not doing nothing. You're alongside them. You're building that kind of trust. Alex, a 22-year-old, told us about the importance of an adult, one of the trusted adults in her life. And she said she's interested in everybody's life. And so she talks about the exciting things in her life. And then she's also excited to talk about things in our lives, which, you know, how, like, any of us can do that. You can be interested, right? I mean, I have a 9-year-old, so sometimes it's really a stretch to be interested in Smash Brothers, which is the current Nintendo Switch game that he's playing. But I do my best, and I sit down and I like learn the characters, right? And I know that what I'm doing is not, like, learning how to play Nintendo is not important. But being interested in whatever he's interested in at 9 lays the foundation so that we can be interested together in the things that he'll be doing at 13 and 15 and 17. And that goes a long way, because I think the overwhelming feeling from a lot of young people is that adults just aren't interested in them.
And that's incarnational, right? You're just getting into their world. Same thing Jesus did with us, come into our world. And I think it's easier to do that when it's tea parties and playing trucks with kids when they're 5, 6, 7, and 8. Mm-hmm. And it's probably more different when it's Fortnite or some kind of video game that you don't even know what in the blazes they're doing anymore.
Music that you don't want to listen to. And
yes,
that's part of showing up as a parent, right?
It is finding your way into their world. And that would go just beyond parenting. I hear from a lot of people who, now that they're not in a more religious structured environment, still have a passion to connect with kids or younger people that are feeling this isolation, feeling alone. So what helps adults to connect with some of these kids that are feeling lonely, isolated? Maybe their parents are checked out or uninvolved, or maybe just they're just got so disciplined that the kids have kind of got alienated from them. How can a non-parent adult find their way? And it's probably gonna be the same thing: showing them that you care, getting into their world with them. Other things?
Well, so we actually were able to boil this down to really 3 steps to create a sense of belonging that the data support for us. 3 pretty distinct stages that emerged from the people we were talking to and from the surveys. And we call it the noticed, named, known framework. And number one is just, it's the simple act of noticing that somebody has shown up in your space. So if you're a non-parent adult in the life of a young person, let's say you're, you know, running an after-school program, or you're a coach, and a kid is hanging around but maybe isn't on the team yet, or isn't, you know, coming into your after-school program, but is sort of on the, you know, hanging out outside your building or outside of your classroom, simply acknowledging their presence. We were told over and over again that was really important, because so many young people feel invisible. And I think there's a lot of ways that can be done, and it takes different formulations in different settings, right? So step one, just noticing, acknowledging somebody's presence. It can be literally as simple as saying hello to them, to let them know that they're seen. And then step two,
because I think even when I stay in people's homes or whatever, I make a real intentional act of trying to open conversations with a kid, saying hi to them, not just being with the adults and kind of, whether we have a kid's table at Thanksgiving or not, there's kind of a kid's table mentality about even our social interactions. And well, they're not going to care. And it's almost always they're not going to care about me. I'm an uncool big adult guy or whatever. But I find that same thing. Just noticing, acknowledging, saying hi opens doors for later. It may not, it may just kind of brush you off kind of quickly there. But when you come back and even remember their name so you can like call them by name and mm-hmm. ask them how their day went, if it was at school or whatever, relationships happen slowly. And if you're looking right. for the immediate response, I think people give up way too soon.
That's true. That small step at the beginning makes a big difference. And it allows you to build on that and get to the other step. So step two being naming. So not just knowing their name, but knowing something about them, right? Knowing their name is important.
Right.
But knowing something about them, being able to involve people in a particular way. The Rabbi Jonathan Sacks defines community as that place where I am known by name and missed if I were gone. And that's a nice little way of summing up what that means to be named in a place. And then the last step there, and again, I think that there's, if you're running a program or whatever, there are ways you can measure this. You can hold your staff accountable to it. You can practice it, et cetera. And then step three is a young person feels known. And what to be known is, it's really this sense that you're not valued for what you can do. You're valued for who you are. And that this place that you're in, this group that you're with, wouldn't be the same without you. And once we get to that, you've been noticed, you've been named, and now you're known and integrated. That's how you create a sense of belonging. That's how relationships form and community is built. And ultimately, that's how beliefs are formed, because we form beliefs from the people around us.
Wow. I'm watching a friend do that. I've talked about him before on the podcast, a Mexican man who lives in the area, former boxer, couple kids asked if he'd help train them do boxing because they couldn't afford to go to a gym. Now he's got 120 kids in two different cities who are showing up, and then other kids come and they look over the fence and they want, because just doing it in the backyard, yeah. they don't have a place to do it. And by getting to know their names, other people looking in, now, particularly here with the current immigration law, a lot of the Mexican people who would like to become legal in the U.S., they've got to show mm-hmm. they're not taking aid. So they've got to move out of the housing projects. And that's allowed African-American from inner city Los Angeles to come out here because they got open housing for people to come.
Sure.
And so now these kids are coming. And this guy's amazing. My friend Lewis, who's working with these kids in boxing, his real thing isn't boxing. His real thing is rescuing kids who are isolated and who are alienated. And now he's got Black kids and Hispanic kids, and he's working at making them a family so that we're not Black kids and Hispanic kids, which is how the gangs normally divide along racial lines. Mm-hmm. He's really looking at the same thing. We're all family here. We get to know each other, and it's names and knowing and asking. And it's all the stuff I see here, which I think is just a wonderful access to help turn people's lives around.
I love that example. That's so, I think that's so powerful that, we're teaching boxing, sure. Nobody would show up if we weren't doing a good job of that, right? But that's not really what we're doing. Like, that's not the, I think to put it, in your terms, like that's not the kingdom work that's going on here. And starting with those youth is really affirmed and confirmed by the research. So John, I hope I get his last name right, because I've only ever seen it running. John Cacioppo and some colleagues wrote this article in 2009 called "Alone in the Crowd: The Structure and Spread of Loneliness in a Large Social Network." And what they looked at was, so how does somebody become lonely? Like, how do we get people on the margins? If I have friends and you have friends, why doesn't that just naturally spread out into a web of friendship for everybody? And what they found is that the way that you combat that, people being on the margins and being disconnected, is not to start with the folks who are at the center. You start with the people who are on the margins. And that is a huge insight. The biggest impact can be made by focusing on noticing, naming, and knowing those people who are right at the fringes. Because what happens is that when you solidify those, they then reach out to more people who are on the fringes and bring them in. And so increasingly your networks get solidified and people are less lonely, as opposed to, drawing an ever tighter circle.
And yet intuitively, whether it's a successful youth group or whatever, it's usually about finding the neat kids who are already well connected and getting them involved. And I like that reversal. It's really, which is what Jesus did. It's what he encouraged us to do. Look for the people that are on the margins. Look for the people that are left out. Look for the people and find your way into relationships with them. And that can be helpful over the long haul. So,
yeah. Yeah, I've seen that, you know, in the, some of the that's one of the things I think is really that connects this early work from church refugees to this work that I'm doing now is that those seem to be the efforts that get people most excited. They sort of, I hate to use this word because I know it's a loaded term, but those are attractional. Like people do want to be a part of efforts that are like that and offering an access to a bigger, greater story. And I don't mean attractional in the same way that we think about doing like big box attractional ministry at mega churches.
Right.
Like that.
I assumed you
something
didn't.
But deeper and more transformative. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Because I know with my friend Lewis, he's got kids now who come and he tries to get them involved in the training and they're not interested in the training. They just want to hang out with the other kids and they want to hang out with him because of, he'll talk to them about, you know, life and they'll talk to them about their journey. And, you know, one kid didn't have any clothes, was embarrassed to come because he just, his clothes were old and torn and dirty. And so he went out and bought him some clothes and gave them to the kid. And the kid comes next time in tears. His mom took all the new clothes and sold them for her drug habit. And so that's the home this kid lives in. But he keeps coming back to this. So now he keeps his clothes at my friend's house. And he's all come over and change here because his mom's going to sell it, which is just a tragedy. And yet if we're not, if people who have a little more stability in their life can't see those kids on the margin, can't name them, can't get to know them, can't get to care about them, can't miss them when they're not around, then they're going to continue to fall through those cracks. It really takes someone because it's not always easy. For I think it takes a certain level of maturity to want to build a relationship with someone who already acts lonely and distant and isolated, right? It's easy when the kid's talkative and, you know, ready to go for it, but it's not for those that just need a hand out of the kind of isolation and despair and loneliness they've gotten into. And they may hate it there, but they don't see how much they communicate, leave me alone, by their demeanor. And how much, if we're going to make a difference here, we've got to ignore that leave me alone demeanor and know that these people do want to belong. They do want to be cared about. They do want to have connection. Because that's the heart. That's the human heart we have is for connection. It's not to be isolated alone.
You're exactly right. And you know, I think that some of the people, I mean, many of the people listening to your show here are probably more well positioned to do this is that we lack the tools to do that. You know, when I mentioned that notice, name, known framework can be like tracked and you can, you know, if you have a staff, you can hold them accountable for it, et cetera. Well, I don't mean that we can do that easily with the traditional tools. Like, I think there's a lot of ways that, you know, lessons from the non-church world that can help us do this, but the church won't, isn't super eager to listen to those tools usually, to those methods.
It's sad, isn't it?
But I think, you know, if you have experience outside of the institutional religious world, you understand how to, you know, how to coach people through a process and how to make sure that they're reaching the kinds of, that they're engaging in the kinds of small actions that will lead to the big transformation. If you've run a business, you know how to work with a sales team from the very beginning of the product announcement all the way up through launch, et cetera. And it's that, not that we want to think about this as transactional, but when it comes to combating things like severe isolation and loneliness, we do need a very sophisticated approach to do it because you're right. Like otherwise it can be easy, you know, to just hang out with the kids who are charismatic and, you know, seem to sort of need you, but maybe not as much.
Yeah. And it's very difficult to pretend you care if you don't care.
That's also very, very true.
And that's where it's got to go. Because if it's just accountability to a program and somebody's watching over you because you got to act like you have to care, kids see through that.
100%.
I've got a friend who ended up with this huge, huge ministry up on the island off Canada. Simply, he taught him maritime. He taught sailing at some maritime college thing or whatever and for high school kids. And these kids would come over, and then he'd invite them over to his house. They'd serve them dinner. They'd teach them how to – their first car they'd get, he'd teach them how to change the oil, do maintenance stuff. Yeah, but all these kids hanging out of his house, and a bunch of them are coming to Jesus and getting saved. And the youth directors of the community invited him, saying, tell us what you're doing. And all he said was, you just got to show kids you care, and they'll show up.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, in my 10 years of telling groups they need to show they care, and no one's ever shown them they care – somehow in an institutional framework, we think the program says we care. The fact that we offer the youth group, the fact that we're here on Wednesday night or we've got this lock-in party or whatever going on. And that's not the same thing as having a heart that says, I really enjoy being with you and I really want to help make your life better if I can. I want to add some value to your life.
Yeah. And I think it's, I think this is so important. So I want to be really clear that, you know, the last time you watched a movie, Wayne, I doubt you stopped at your local Blockbuster Video to check out the tape and bring it home.
You can bet on that.
Right. But that doesn't mean you stop watching movies, right? Like, you still watch movies. The fear that I have is that youth workers and other people will think like, oh, well, you know, it can't be true that programs don't matter. I know that they were really important. You know, like I can just do it better and my program will matter again. And that's like trying to buy movies from Blockbuster in 2019. The world has changed. And it's not that Blockbuster was bad. In the 80s, it was great. I mean, I was like astonished that I could just go and pick out like whatever.
And browse forever and just find the movie you wanted. Yeah.
It was incredible.
Yeah.
But now it doesn't make any sense. And so I think it really is time, you know, people who are taking this message seriously will want to celebrate that, affirm what was really good out of it, and put it to bed and understand that relationships can't be done in that same way. And again, in a world that has shifted where relationships are the thing that matters, that's where it's got to be.
Which is a great thing for us to sit here and say relationships matter more than programs. You're singing a song I've been singing for 40 years.
Sure.
Even when I was a pastor going, the program isn't it, man. People's needs are too important to put into a program. They need a connection. They need a relationship with someone who cares. Well, Josh, we're on the backside of it here time-wise. Is there anything else you want to throw in here that would be helpful? Or are we pretty much covered
it? Always, at Springtide, we're really committed to not just understanding the lives of 13 to 25-year-olds, but understanding the lives of the people who work with them. And so if you're interested in what we're doing, and we would love to hear from you to hear about what you're doing that works, you can. My email address is josh@springtideresearch.org. You can go to our website, which is springtideresearch.org, and find us there. We're really committed to understanding what it looks like to show up for kids, for young people, not just kids, in your daily lives. And we know a lot of that happens in unofficial ways that we would never be able to track down. So if people want to share, we'd love to hear.
Great. And we'll put those links on the show notes. So people who want to go just click on your email address or whatever, they'll be able to find you. So thanks for your time, Josh. Appreciate it very much.
This is great as always, Wayne.
Appreciate what you do. Stay in touch.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.